I have an interview coming up here in a minute with Dr. John Alexander, author of a new book, Reality Denied. And Dr./Colonel John Alexander is an interesting guy. I'm not really quite sure what to make of it. We talked for quite a long time, and we, of course, covered this new book and all about his amazing experiences, shamanic experiences, his research into near-death experience and remote viewing and all sorts of things. But I was still trying to figure this guy out. And near the end of the interview, he kind of let out this little thing about the warrior monk. Because I was like, John, you know, how do you square all this stuff in your head? This interest in spirituality, this interest in enlightenment, and yet this other interest in making war. This is a Green Beret. Don't forget, this is a Green Beret, tour of duty, Vietnam, tour of duty, Afghanistan, kind of the real deal. So I really kind of latched on to this idea of the warrior monk and was really exploring that and trying to understand that.
What kind of monk are you, huh? Stealing from travelers. Ah, asylum when I see. Or death. I'm speaking to you, monk.
Okay, Jackie Chan's about to whip ass on some Jet Li here in the movie The Forbidden Kingdom. But before we go there, I want to return to this topic of the warrior monk, because I think it's certainly relevant to this show, but I think it's also relevant to some of the larger issues regarding exploring consciousness, extended consciousness, and all the things we talk about. Because the idea of the warrior monk is that, you know, even if you're the most peace-loving, enlightenment-seeking spiritual community, before long you'll find that you need those freaking monks, man. You need someone to protect your shit, because if you don't, someone who has their own version of their enlightenment, spiritual, peace-loving thing is going to come over and kick your ass and take your stuff, and that's the reality. And that's still the reality. That's our political reality. That's the number one thing we look for government to do, is to protect our shit. And we can pretend that's not real, or we're past that, or the internet's going to take care of that. But the warrior monk says no, man. The warrior monk says that's just the way it is. And that part of it might help you understand my approach to this interview. Because before I read his latest book, Reality Denied, about all his spiritual experiences, the one thing I knew about John Alexander was that he was the guy that denied UFOs. But I kept reading this book, and I'm trying to square it with what I guess has for a long time been the general overriding meme associated with John Alexander, which is this guy who debates people at UFO conferences saying that the government doesn't know anything about UFOs, and if they did, I would know that they did, and I know, and they don't. And what is that whole meme all about? Is that something you, is that an accurate characterization of the way a lot of people think of you? It seems to be out there, and is it true?
I can't speak to what other people think, but I don't think, particularly with the recent revelations, that I can say if it were there, I would know about it.
Now, wait, before we get to some serious word parsing, which he does, you know, his answer is okay, but it doesn't capture, for those of you who aren't familiar with the whole UFO thing, it doesn't capture how just freaking annoying this has been for years and years and years. I mean, let me play this next clip for you. And it's from, 2011, I think, this UFO conference. And here is John Alexander again being grilled by Danny Sheehan, who is can grill people because he's an attorney, and he's a really good attorney. By the way, he was the attorney, if you don't know this, for John Mack you know, the UFO abduction researcher, Harvard University, everyone points out. I mean, he's teaching psychology at Harvard, and then he gets into this UFO abduction thing, and he goes, it's real. He gets censored by Harvard, and Danny Sheehan comes in because John Mack's no idiot. He's a really sharp guy, and he goes, you can't censor me for this. And he gets Dan Sheehan to sit in there in that first meeting with the Harvard guys, and very quickly they fold their hand and let John Mack continue. But I digress, but here is how annoying this has been over the years.
The fact is that you aren't saying, I'm trying to find out, are you willing to agree that just because you haven't found it and the people you talked to didn't acknowledge it to you, that it could still well exist?
Oh, I say that in the book. Mm-hmm. In fact, I come up and I say, you know, I base what I have on firsthand evidence, which I think is broader than anybody else, because I talked to the head or deputy of all of the lettered agencies and all of that.
Which makes it hearsay.
Now, could I have, and I specifically say that, could I have missed it? Possible. Don't think so. But the point is, on all of these conspiracies, and I have slides, you know, I have a whole thing on how conspiracies work and that.
Yeah, I was on three of those you need that you admitted groups. Were true.
That's not in that briefing. But the point here is, all of them have been found out.
And not by the government, though.
I didn't say by the government.
And not by the journalists, but the point and is not by the national public. Security investigators.
Let me give an example. Glomar Explorer.
Okay, before we get too far, you have to fully appreciate this grilling that's going on. First, notice that, you know, Colonel Alexander says, I have firsthand knowledge. And then he goes on to say, I talked to these guys and these guys. And Sheehan points out, well, that isn't really firsthand knowledge. That's secondhand knowledge, because you're passing along what someone already told you. But more importantly, you can sense the frustration at the parsing. Step back. Here is a guy who's saying, I've talked to the highest ranking officials in the government, and there's no UFO program. They don't know anything about UFOs. There's nothing out there. We all knew it was bullshit. Everybody knew it was bullshit, but that didn't matter. It didn't matter until December 16th, 2017. New York Times and our friend Leslie Kane, who, that's a whole other story, but they dropped the truth bomb.
Dude, this is a fucking drone, bro. There's a whole fleet of them. Look on the ASA. My gosh. They're all going against the wind. The wind's 120 knots to the west. The whole thing, dude.
Now, notice that I titled that slide Control Disclosure question mark. And it's hard with this show because this show's about consciousness and spirituality, really. But in a minute, I'll tell you why I think it relates to this in a really important, profound way. But just stepping back and dealing with the conspiratorial aspect of this again, you got to kind of put that hat on for a minute and say, okay, New York Times, the official record, at least for still a lot of people, not for a lot of other people, but the New York Times has now said, okay, guys, it's real. But the point is, if it's real, then it's always been real, right? Then it's been real for 50, 60 years. It's been real, right? It isn't like they're pretending like this is the first or only UFO program, right? So John Alexander, you talked to everyone and they said there's nothing, right? So I said a minute ago that this stuff does relate back to Skeptico, does relate back to consciousness science or consciousness understanding, however you want to put it, and spirituality. So I guess it's fair to ask how. How does it? Check out this.
His wife suddenly wants to talk about, I'd like to talk about entanglement, particle entanglement. And I'm thinking, Why would you ask us? Your husband is a PhD in physics. He runs the parapsychology, the phenomenology desk at the CIA.
The weird desk.
The weird desk. And what people have to realize is that when the CIA calls it phenomenology, that is a hint as to what's going on. It is not UFOs. It's remote viewing, ghosts, parapsychology, the telepathy. It's the whole ball of wax because it's all consciousness. That's the ground of being. It's consciousness. And they know that. And that's why when the Canadian government document said in 1950 that mental phenomena may be involved, the top secret Canadian government document said mental phenomena may be involved in flying saucers. That's when they started the MK Ultra stuff. That's when they started all that, because they were trying to figure out how does consciousness work, because they had a live alien in 1947. That's how the Americans knew to tell the Canadians in 1950 that mental phenomena was involved. Nobody was talking to aliens in 1950. There were Adamski and Williamson would not come forward until a couple days after the detonation of the hydrogen bomb. Betty and Barney Hill would not become public until the mid-60s. Nobody said they were talking to aliens, in public at least. And so therefore, how did they know that mental phenomena was involved? Because they had a live alien. And they knew that the alien is telepathic and it gets in your head. And they went, wow, man, if we could discover how this worked. And so, of course, they threw every dime they had at consciousness trying to figure out how this thing worked.
Mind blown. That, of course, is Grant Cameron, who's been on the show a couple of times, I think is one of the best UFO researchers. And let me just say, I know this stuff is a little bit out there for some people. For other people who like Skeptico, it's like old hat. And for other people who like Skeptico, it's like out there, like way out there. Aliens, they had an alien and all the rest of this stuff. But it's real. I mean, the Wilbur Smith memo that he referenced, we did a whole show on that. It's real. It's a document released from the Canadian government, a top secret document. And, you know, Grant's research, extremely thorough researcher. He went and traced, can we rely on this document? Is it real? Is it faked? And they're totally real. And as he alludes to there, if you really start putting together pieces, and I know he talks really fast, that leads to this interest in consciousness. That leads to MK Ultra. That leads to Stargate remote viewing. It was in response to what they were finding over here. That's the connection that Grant's making. And I think the connection is undeniable in terms of how things play out. And if it wasn't undeniable before, go back and read the New York Times and watch that video. I mean, they kind of tried to hide it, but we all knew this stuff was real. But let's get back to today's interview with John Alexander for a minute. One of the things I did after the show was I talked to my buddies at the Grimerica show, because they had interviewed Grant Cameron and they've done a lot of research on this. So I got on a video chat with Darren and Graham, and I asked them what I think one of the essential questions, key questions to be asked about Dr. Alexander.
You know, an offensive defense.
Yeah, well, we in the West are very good at offensive defense.
Yeah.
It's almost
so. Final question before I there's actually the big question is at the end, is whether I've roped you guys into a career-ending decision or not. But the question before that is John Alexander a misinformation agent?
I think he's. You know, I'm not sure that he is. I think Graham will probably disagree with me, but I don't know. For some reason, I just get the vibe of somebody who's, you know, maybe misses the Green Beret days, likes a little, you know.
We thought he was bullshitting before a little. So
that's what I mean. Like he misses.
Oh, it's days. Not. It's not an. It's not an
attention. Now he can.
It's not a shill type of bullshitting. It's egoic kind of thing.
He's caught in it. You know, he said some shit one time, and now you're sort of caught in it. You know, it's like one of those, you know, what's that old saying about, you know, lies, where it's, you know, gets out of hand fucking quick. I mean, we see that happen today all the time, where these guys get, and today, in today's world, you get burned fucking fast. But
yeah, I don't know. I tend to think he's probably
stuck with it.
He's probably a disinformation agent. I'm skeptical of that whole side of the research, the whole side, the PK, all that stuff now, I'm kind of skeptical of. Kind of mixes all together with the MK Ultra and UFOs and disclosure, and I don't know.
I wonder if I'm being MK Ultra'd right now.
Yeah, maybe.
Actually, we're in a Faraday cage, so we should be good.
You know, it's almost like he's disinformation, misinformation by definition, you know. So whether he's being whether he's being directed, controlled, fed the stuff, or whether he's just being allowed to be a mouthpiece for the misinformation, disinformation. He's clearly, I mean, as we've deconstructed it, it's just, it doesn't hold up.
And not only that, he's probably feeling like his job is being threatened because all these old school disinformation guys are just being replaced with trolls, online trolls. You know, that's the new battlefield. You don't need these guys going on the news anymore. You just need a billion fucking bots on Twitter.
Can the warrior monk be replaced by a billion bots on Twitter? I don't know. Maybe we'll find out in this interview with John Alexander, who, you know, really has written a terrific book, Reality Denied, a book that covers a lot of topics that we touch on in this interview, including near-death experience research and his experience in that, his experience with the Stargate program that I mentioned ago. Also, current news like Tom DeLonge, Disclosure, MyLab stuff, which he completely categorically says is totally not real, untrue. What else did we talk about? We talk about the aviary and other UFO stuff, but we talk about a lot of non-UFO stuff. This book is really about the consciousness kind of stuff that Skeptico is kind of built on, but I just had to go with the UFO stuff because you can't do that. You can't do the head fake stuff. You can't have a whole career built on extended consciousness UFO alien stuff and then say, yeah, but now all I want to talk about are shamans. And to be fair, I mean, that he answered all the questions. He didn't dodge a single question. And I commend him for that. I just can't quite figure him out. So before we get to the interview, just a couple of cleanup things. You know, last episode, I reached out and asked people if they were interested in helping the show, helping me in any way to reach out to me. And it's just been phenomenal. Such a cool response. So many awesome people I've met, I've talked to, I've video chatted with, and there's going to be some great stuff that comes out of that. Great new content and a great little help on doing stuff. So, so appreciate that. Especially just appreciate connecting with you all. That's so cool. So again, if anyone ever wants to connect with me, do it. I'm pretty accessible. Just send me an email. So I think that'll do it. Let's get on to this interview with Dr. John Alexander, author of the new book, Reality Denied. Today we welcome Dr. John Alexander to Skeptico to talk about his new book, Reality Denied, First-Hand Experiences with Things That Can't Happen, But Did. Dr. Alexander is a retired U.S. Army colonel with a list of military and non-military distinctions, which are way too long to mention on this show. He's one of those people, as you'll hear about when he talks about this book, who really has seen it all and done it all. At least it seems that way. Fortunately, he has written a book about it. Reality Denied, again, is the title. John, welcome to Skeptico. Thanks for joining me.
Oh, glad to be here.
So we're talking on a landline. It's a little bit unfortunate. I was really hoping we could have done video because I have seen interviews from your home in Las Vegas. And it's quite an amazing place. I think it fits into this book in that you've almost compiled almost a museum quality collection of things that you've gathered from around the world that support this amazing journey that you've been on of discovering of strange things. So is that true?
Pretty much. Victoria likes to pick up stuff, and we have been to a lot of places. I've tried to convince her there's more crosses in the world than anybody can possibly own. But no, we do have a lot of items from most of the places we've been.
So in this book, Reality Denied, as I mentioned, it's an amazing account. Way, way too many stories to tell in an hour, but we have UFOs, near-death experience, psychic spying, medium spoon bending, men who stare at goats. It goes on and on and on. It seems like no matter what area related to extended consciousness and military interest in the paranormal, you've somehow been connected with at a really, really deep level, almost at the beginning of every one of these things. But your book is also about what I like to call deep spirituality, which is a frequent topic of this show. And I almost feel like it's where we should begin, because it seems to me where you come down on the spirituality question, if you will, is to approach it not so much because of any kind of religious reasons you might have, but because it's at the fundamental core, it seems to be, of who we are and what we are. And speak for a minute about that, about spirituality, about what it means, about how it fits into this whole big picture of reality.
Well, I might mention the book is divided into four parts, and one of those I did title Spirituality. I might mention a little war story, if you will, but when I was doing my doctoral dissertation, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was the head of my committee, and I think many of the people will know her, certainly in the medical community. She's the one who brought hospice to the U.S., and of course, with Ray Moody, started the whole area of non or near-death experiences. She made me change one word in the dissertation, and that was from religious to spirituality. And it had profound impact on the outcome of the writing, because many people chose, I had an instrument that people responded to, and many of them said, you know, I reject the dogma of the church, but I think I have a spiritual connection with higher beings, and I think it's much broader than the, quote, religious context, if you will. One of the things that I have found, as you notice, I've dealt with shamans from all over the world, and that outside of Europe and U.S., the notion of a spirit world is generally accepted. In the West, we have a materialistic worldview that says, you know, you can cut things into smaller and smaller pieces and eventually get to the God particle, Higgs boson, or now pentaquarks, or whatever. But in other areas of the world, they do not draw that distinction. Even with people who are highly educated, often educated in, you know, Western traditions, but they accept, you know, that there is a spirit world. When I deal with shamans, I might mention that, you know, they seem to move seamlessly back and forth between the spirit world and what we would call a consensus reality, or the, quote, real world. So,
John, let me just interject a couple of things, because I remember that anecdote from the book, and it's stunning. It's an example of what I just talked about. I mean, here's a guy, you know, he's going to write a book, and he's going to talk about his experience with near-death experience. And the very beginning of that is Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. A lot of people don't know it. They associate it with Raymond Moody, but it was actually Elizabeth Kubler-Ross who went to Raymond Moody and said, hey, I can't include this in my book. I have enough to tackle here with hospice. Why don't you tackle near-death experience? And that's how that future begins. And then you roll that back into that future, and lo and behold, you're there, and she's telling you, don't say religiousness, say spirituality. I mean, it's an amazing story, and it hints to kind of there's one story like that after another in this book, and you're like, how has this guy been at the beginning of all this? But let's take it back to the question of spirituality,
And we can either go backwards in time or forwards in time. Because as you just mentioned, you go forwards in time and you're down there with your wife doing spirit possessions with shaman in Brazil. I mean, this is like in the last couple of years. Crazy stuff that most people don't talk about. But you can also go back in your history and you have experiences on the battlefield with people who say, yeah, that NDE stuff, I know it's real because I've seen it on the battlefield and I've, you know, left my body or seen my body or had near-death experience and stuff like that. So let's again try and fly over this thing at 50,000 feet. What is spirituality? You've had such a broad experience with it in so many ways. How do you define it in your life? I mean, why are you going down to Brazil with your wife? Why are you subjecting yourself to these experiences with shaman? What does it all mean to you?
I wish I had a good answer for that, and certainly nothing succinct. I often get asked, you know, how did I transform? And I say there was no epiphany, in other words, some magical transformational incident. It's been more like turning a cruise ship or an aircraft carrier where you see slight change. I've always been interested in things unusual and have followed that for, you know, absolutely decades. A lot of this revolves around Victoria, my wife. We'll probably get into ayahuasca, for instance, and she's a devotee and one who's willing to take great leaps in these areas. And it's one of those things that for listeners, as you get involved, it just, the doors keep opening, sort of the gift that keeps on giving, if you will.
Okay, let me try this one more time. Well, how about just some of the fundamental questions that people really struggle with at the end of the day? Morality, good and bad. Does God exist? Is there an ultimate truth? Is there a moral imperative? Is there a good and bad? Or is it just a big blob out there of consciousness and spirits and, you know, a demon-haunted world where people are pushing and pulling, but there's no real order to any of it?
Well, that's very difficult to say. As I mentioned, I'll use an example of my UFO book. The first line was, UFOs are real. And the last paragraph is, whatever this is, it is more complex than we could possibly imagine. And in all of my presentations, I have a slide that shows early that incorporates many of these things, from UFOs, near-death experiences, remote viewing, spontaneous healing, firewalking, et cetera, and in my view, those are all interconnected in some way, and certainly consciousness is a piece of it. Personal philosophy is I am into recycling, i.e., you know, coming back again or reincarnation. And so maybe when you get issues of morality, or these are lessons that each individual are going to be confronted with and have to learn at some juncture.
So let's break down. There's so many different directions we can go, but near-death experience science is something we've talked a lot about on this show. And again, I hate to repeat myself, but you're right in the middle of that research. You're deeply connected with some of the early near-death experience researchers. You're deeply connected with the original formation of IANS. So you are very much a person to talk to and ask these questions about. With regard to near-death experience research, we have clearly, I think, evidence, and this is what you say in the book, and I completely agree with you, the evidence is overwhelming that it's highly suggestive that consciousness survives bodily death. The skeptical counter explanations for that are just really kind of shamefully stupid in just a lot of ways, and scientifically not very strong in a lot of ways. But again, let me take that one step further. One of the near-death experience researchers I always think does an extremely good job with the data is oncologist Dr. Jeffrey Long, who's published a couple books, but is the first person who's done I guess, the most comprehensive survey of near-death experience survivors. And he approaches this question of morality, the God question, is there a purpose? And the data that he finds scientifically is overwhelmingly, that's what people are saying when they come back, that there are people that have negative near-death experiences. There are negative aspects to some of these experiences, but those are a small, small fraction of the overall experience. Overall, people are finding, one, that it is not religious, that it can't be pigeonholed into a Christian experience or any other religious experience, but that it, two, it is basically confirming of what religion has told us, that there is an afterlife, there is a judgment associated with that afterlife, there is a review, there is a morality to life, there is good and bad, and that you should try and do good things. I'm not trying to turn this into some kind of religious discussion. I'm not a religious person. I'm just saying, to me, this is the level two discussion that your book begs, which is, it begs the question of, what does this mean now? So what does this near-death experience mean when we start looking at it in that way? And it seems to suggest that there is more in terms of the deep meaning that many have associated with the near-death experience. What do you think, John?
Well, I think you've just made a strong argument for the issues of spirituality versus religion. In some of my recent comments online, I've been mentioning that from these religious issues that come up, that if the founder ever came back in Christianity, he wouldn't recognize what's going on today, certainly. That hypocrisy tends to be rampant. Yeah, there are common messages and inferences. I was interested in cases that in which certain things happen, again, being kind of a scientist and approaching it from that perspective. You know, what is the evidence that supports that the incidents are, in fact, real? And there's some, I think, compelling stories of individuals who acquire information during this period when they were out of their body and ability to observe things that they did not have access to in any physical means whatsoever. You also find precognitive aspects to it, where they are given information about the future that then turns out to be, you know, quite accurate. You had mentioned before, you know, past time, the future time. One of the things we tend to come up with is there probably is no time, and that our entire concept of time is wrong, though we use it to mark a passage of, you know, as we progress in this lifetime.
Agreed. And I think that those are the kind of things that you mosey into, just like you did, just from one sentence to another. And then you realize that you're kind of in a deep swamp as soon as you start saying, well, by all evidence we have, there is no such thing as time. And it's kind of an arbitrary overlay that we put on things. It's like, wow, how are we even talking about things like past lives or things like between lives or things like afterlife? All those things, the meaning becomes very fuzzy. Yet at the same time, this is what we're trying to pull apart, isn't it?
Well, I think it was Einstein who said it's sort of an illusion, albeit a very persistent one.
Yeah. Let me ask you another question about the near-death experience science, because it's something I've delved into a lot. Do you think that the scientific establishment, the neuroscience establishment, is playing it straight with this pushback they have against near-death experience science? I mean, I take, for example, something we covered a lot was Dr. Eben Alexander, after the publication of course, a Harvard neuroscientist, publishes a best-selling book, Proof of Heaven. There's just this orchestrated pushback against the work, and it just doesn't seem real in a way. It doesn't seem, it seems to be coming from another place with another agenda that isn't quite disclosed in terms of why there would be such an orchestrated pushback on something that you kind of alluded to with the South American thing is widely accepted throughout the world and is widely accepted even among among people in the United States. I mean, afterlife is widely accepted. And then if you look at it from a historical perspective, boy, I mean, this is like a brief little blip we have here in time of this small group of materialist science who've denied this. Is there something more? Is there something else pushing that agenda? That's a question I guess we will return to time and again when we talk about different things. But how about with you, with near-death experience?
Well, I think many people would agree that we are a fear-based society in many things that we do. And from a materialistic viewpoint, if this stuff is right, then the foundations of your entire belief system are at risk. And that's very, very scary. Now, there's another piece of it, I think, that gets into more into the religious domain. And that has to do with the control factor, where priests or, you know, various spiritual leaders want to be the arbiters of information. And one of the things that I have found is that in dealing with any of these areas that allow for direct experience of a divine being or external consciousness, they would prefer to be the ones who are the arbiters and, you know, present what the facts are, as opposed to having individuals who say, I've been there and done that.
Does that extend into government agencies?
Well, you'd have to extrapolate government there, because remember, there are governments in the world that are theocratic, so that by definition is a religious influence. I don't see it so much in the Western world, unless you're talking about the general area of secrecy, because there, I mean, let's understand, across the board, in all domains, information is power. And so he who controls information controls considerable amount of power and therefore influence.
Right. Which is, you know, John, I'm reading this amazing book of yours and I'm reading these amazing stories, some of which we just have to cover because we have to get this out there for folks who don't have a chance to read it. And you really should read Reality Denied if you can't find a dozen just completely paradigm-shattering stories there just by sticking your thumb into the book at any random place. Well, then I don't know how you couldn't, I guess, is my point. But I kept reading this book, and I'm trying to square it with what I guess has for a long time been the general overriding meme associated with John Alexander, which is this guy who debates people at UFO conferences saying that the government doesn't know anything about UFOs, and if they did, I would know that they did, and I know, and they don't. And what is that whole meme all about? Is that something is that an accurate characterization of the way a lot of people think of you? It seems to be out there, and is it true?
I can't speak to what other people think. But I don't think, particularly with the recent revelations, that I can say if it were there, I would know about it. I think if you're talking about the recent stuff that To the Stars has been fortunate enough to release on studies that are going on, what you find is you have tiny pockets of people who have had personal experience and the ability to research that. One of the things I mentioned in all of these phenomena, be it UFOs, near-death experiences, precognition, you know, take your phenomena. Remember, the government, whatever that is made up of millions of individuals. And what we know is across the board that a vast number of them, probably more than a majority, have had some kind of psychic experience in their life. If it's UFOs, probably 10% have actually seen something that they believe. Adults, and particularly in the military, who have been in threatening situations, you find people who have had near-death experiences. Now, one of the areas where I get into some difficulty in is that when you get into these areas and say, well, the government should study this, we're talking about the U.S. government now, I argue that's not necessarily the case. You do not expect that the government is responsible for confirming one's individual belief system. Although, you know, to be fair, and this goes, I think, to all of the various phenomena, you do find each individual comes to the institution with their set belief system. And there certainly have been some who have used that, you know, in ways that would be probably inappropriate. One of the things that just came out in the recent release is that there were people who believed in UFOs but said we shouldn't do that because they're these are demonic and we shouldn't be involved. We saw that in the remote viewing program who said we had opponents who said, yeah, you can probably do that, but we should not be involved because it's the work of the devil. So in all cases, you have individuals, both pro and con, bringing individual belief systems into potential study or looking at these issues, and they're terribly, terribly complex, so whatever we're dealing with.
Let me try and pin it down with a breaking story in the last couple of weeks, and I don't know if you were referring to that in a couple of things you say, but...
I am.
Okay, so everyone's heard of the New York Times UFO story, right? And we could also talk about Tom DeLonge, but the UFO story breaks in the New York Times. For people who are connected to the UFO community, they're like, well, this is the tip of the iceberg. We've known about this stuff forever. But for the general population, it still seems to be more of a bombshell than I guess I could have anticipated, that people are going, look, it's real. The government has known about UFOs. And then I just want you to clarify where you've stood in the past on this kind of information, because it just seems to me, just being totally blunt, that you've always been a guy who said this kind of stuff couldn't possibly be happening, and if it was happening, I would know about it.
Well, let's understand, I retired in 88, and I certainly didn't know everything, but I think I can say, well, first of all, I ran such a study throughout most of the 1980s, up until the time that I retired. The difference between what Lou was able to do and me is he got funded. We did not. Many of the same players. I had representatives from all of the services across the intelligence community and aerospace industry involved. One of the things we found, by the way, which is identical to what they discovered, is nobody's in charge. So what you had in this case is an individual who was interested, GS-15, and able to put together a tiny study. Now, when you say the government says, one of the things I used to do when I was assigned in the Pentagon is to run around and say, where is this guy? You have to, the Pentagon says this and the Pentagon says that. The Pentagon doesn't say anything. It's a big stone building. There are tens of thousands of people who work there with a wide variety of beliefs. One of the things I've just heard, I have to confirm yet, is that Secretary Mattis learned about this program a few hours before the New York Times broke, meaning this is not a concerted effort. It was an individual putting together the resources that he could. By the way, one of the things that does pop up is the Reed Bigelow connection, and I do understand that that was a competitive bid and that Bass or Bigelow Aerospace actually won it. But that you have pockets that are involved should not surprise people. I also see a big discussions about whether the threat-based aspect of this. That does not surprise me at all. It is exactly what I did 30 years ago. And the point is, it is the Department of Defense, not the Department of Interesting Ideas or weird stuff to cover. So in order to get funding, you had to put it in some kind of context where it could withstand a degree of scrutiny. You also find out that over time, a very small group, which is definitely the way to do it, but as the program became visible, it became under, you know, more and more attacks. And eventually, you know, as I've always said, even in the black world, it's a zero-sum game. There is competition for the resources. And what did happen here is they got to a point where other people wanted the money, quite frankly. And so you saw a discontinuation. Remember, we're talking $22 million over 5 years, which I actually ran the numbers. We were talking about 0.001% of the budget, i.e. small.
Yes. Let's touch on another topic in the news, because it again relates directly back to the book, Reality Denied, and some of the important people in that book, in this case, Hal Puthoff. So I'm referring to the Tom DeLonge disclosure, which a lot of people look at as some kind of controlled disclosure. I don't know if there's any other way to look at it. Of course, Tom DeLonge is this famous rock star, Blink 182 guy, close associations with the Democratic side of the equation, with his association with the Clinton campaign and Podesta and the supposed disclosure that was going to come about. So now Tom DeLonge has come out with this blue ribbon committee. We're going to take this stuff to the stars. The government, again, the government, if you'll forgive me, I mean, that's the only term we can use, but there's top ranking officials within the intelligence, military intelligence community and the government community that are joining on board. One of them is Hal Puthoff, and there's this other group of star-studded people in the know, both from the military contractors and from the military themselves, and we're going to build this spacecraft based on this technology that's been revealed to us, and here we go. Forget about the larger social implications of visitation by aliens from another planet. We're just going to go grind out some technology. The whole thing looks completely contrived to me, and yet at the same time, it does seem to have some reality to it. Tell us what you make of Hal Puthoff. Tell us what you make of Tom DeLonge. Tell us what you make of what appears to be controlled and deliberate drip-by-drip disclosure.
Okay, for the next 3 days, we're going to first of all, for a disclosure, Hal has been a personal friend for decades, so know him very well. And you'll also find one of the things I mentioned in the book, by the way, is that, you know, certain people seem to reappear from time to time in different areas. He was instrumental in the remote viewing program, interested in the PK, and of course has an independent lab down there in Austin. I've spoken with him once. I have never met him, so I don't know. I know a number of the other people who were integrally involved, but not all of them. And you're right in describing it as a, you know, quite a stellar group. Where I would disagree is that this is any kind of contrived release of information. Again, it was a very small study. Pieces of it are ongoing by all accounts. Where it's getting funded or if it's getting funded does not seem to be clear. But, you know, there are individuals, and where I do agree strongly with most of the people from the To the Stars is that there is a huge problem with overclassification. And one of the things I've gone kind of out on a limb on and saying, studying this strictly from a government or military perspective, I think is wrong. Because while the study, as far as I know, what they looked at were cases that did happen to the military, and understand all of that. But there are far more things happening to just everybody. Remember, this is a global phenomenon, and, you know, seems to have intensified over time, but the reports go back millennia. And you had raised the question of contact and that. My point is that there have been reports or allegations of contact between humans and sentient non-humans throughout the entirety of human history, throughout every culture. This is why when I get back to saying whatever we're dealing with is terribly, terribly complex. So I think this is just one of the many data points. I think that they have acquired some data that do look interesting. But having said that, I think when it gets down to the bottom line questions, like what is it, where does it come from, how can this all be, I don't think they're any closer than anybody else.
So let's assume that they're somewhat earnest in what they're putting forth. Do you say that's a valid approach to just go in there and grab what you can and just say, okay, let's just try and engineer it from a technology standpoint and not worry about what you're finding in the jungles of the Amazon with your wife and being possessed by spirits and how spirits run the whole world? Is it valid just to, I'm overstating that, okay, forgive me, but is it valid to just take a wrench and try and...
When I ran the study 30 years ago, one of the things that we put forward, remember, I again was in the Defense Department and trying to make a case to get funded, but didn't. But A, the reality of it and why you would want to do it, there were two issues. One's threat. You know, you got something flying around you don't understand. The other was advance in technology. That whether or not you actually had your hands on hardware or something like that, that if you just understood the principles, for instance, we saw the avionics, rapid acceleration, G-force turns that, you know, nobody could survive. And all of these have been reported, again, at least since the 40s, that if we had an understanding of what would be required to do that, that there was a potential for leapfrog in technology. We're not successful, but the approach is totally valid.
So again, let's juxtapose that with the spiritual actions and the spiritual questions, because fundamentally spirituality comes down to action. In the same way that military operations come down to action and what is right action, what is non-action, what difference does action make in this spiritual realm in which we find ourselves? You many times in the book allude to the idea that we are spiritual beings living a physical life. I mean, you allude to that several times in the book, and I think it's kind of at the core of what you seem to be about. There does... for a lot of folks, seem to be a contradiction in terms of what it takes to be a soldier and what it takes to thwart threats and what it takes to live a spiritual life. I mean, it's a big question, but it's the question.
But the concept of the warrior monk has been around for eons.
Tell us. You wrote a book on that. This has been your life. I mean, so expound on that.
Well, no, that the concept that you come to understand these things, and you do encounter paradoxes. I mean, I must say that. I won't get into some of the personal aspects of this, but I mean, I go back to Vietnam because I was there I was also in Afghanistan in 2003 and looking at the physical actions there, and questions become, how do you take life if you believe that, you know, all things are interconnected and that, you know, well, life is worth living, and as I mentioned, as said, being a spiritual being. It is, you know, difficult to explain. I think what we see is kind of spiritual evolution that takes time with the realities that faces individuals. I might mention that the, you know, we spent a huge amount of money, and we have over the last 16 years exposed a lot of people to combat. And I think we do not begin to understand the cost of that, not in dollars and cents, but the impact of people who have been exposed to violent conflict, who have inflicted violent conflict. What I can tell you is that over time, those things do come back to revisit you.
I think that's probably true. Tell you what, this is going to be a very fast-moving hour, and there's a couple of other points that we just have to talk about. In terms of stories, you have to share with people your experience bending spoons with Uri Geller, and the story about the spoon that I presume you still have in your office, at least you described that you still have in your office from the book. Could you tell that whole story?
Sure. I'm looking at the spoon as we speak. What had happened, and I might mention Uri Geller, as you know, did the foreword to the book, and I've known him for decades. But he had come to the U.S., and I might mention this is still a bad old days, i.e. Soviet Union was still intact, breaking up a bit, but I'm guessing 1987 timeframe. And he had come in, and what he wanted to talk about, being Jewish, was the plight of the Soviet Jews not being allowed to immigrate to Israel and what we could do to help that. So he arranged a meeting. This was in the U.S. Capitol, and there actually is a SCIF there, which is a secured facility, present were some senators, a few congressmen, mostly staffers, and I knew this was going to take place, so I was sitting maybe 4 feet. I was in the very front row, right dead set in front of him, and of course, everybody, he was talking, again, about his area of interest, how to help Jewish immigration, and everybody said, bend something. And he said, well, I haven't got anything. So they had to go out to the guard and get the spoon that came out of his coffee cup. The reason that's significant is there's no way in hell that he had, you know, any preparation of the spoon itself. Held it with the bowl inverted with his thumb and forefinger and brought it one, you know, his forefinger and right hand down. And he did not grab the neck or grab the entire spoon at all and stroke it gently, and the spoon bent, the handle bent upwards. He then placed it on the back of the chair that was nearby and went on talking, and the spoon continued to bend while he's talking about other things.
And which direction did it bend, John?
It was bending upwards.
Bending upwards, so it's kind of defying gravity. In addition to everything else it's doing, it's defying gravity as it's bending.
That's the point. And again, there's no time did the neck of the spoon disappear. That's one of the things you can look for fakes. By the way, they should know, we had other magicians who were, in fact, involved in the studies. Doug Henning, I mentioned him in the book. But had world-class magicians involved in this. As I said, it bent and fell on the floor and ended up in my pocket.
Yeah, that's pretty remarkable. So connected to this whole thing with Uri Geller is your association with the Stargate program, your association with Joe McConnell, who's been on this show and is Psychics by 001. A lot of interesting stories associated with that. And related to that is the whole Men Who Stare at Goats, John Ronson thing, who goes on to interviews you and goes on to make this kind of wacky movie. So many questions.
Well, actually, I want to interject there that I still claim he never interviewed me. He was, in fact, present. I know I went on the air when I first heard him talking about this. I had to go back and check my records. And what had happened, there was a British filmmaker by the name of John Sargent who had called me and arranged for the interview and came. And John was doing the interview and actually filming it. And it turns out Ronson was there. And it was Jimmy Chan and I said, well, he was more like a grip. Certainly not the key guy. He may have asked a question or two, but saying he interviewed me is just totally incorrect.
But that's one of the more interesting questions related to the whole area of information, misinformation, disinformation. Why does this film get made? Why is it made the way that it is? Why is the information portrayed the way that it is? I mean, there's a million questions that no one even asks, but it seems to me very convenient that the whole project gets put off as in this kind of laugh it off kind of way when you spent your career, a good part of your career, in non-lethal weapons connected to very strange but very real paranormal phenomenon that were connected to this kind of thing. Do you have any thoughts related to, one, either setting the record straight in terms of what really happened in terms of these non-lethal weapons, or number two, why it was portrayed the way it was in at that time?
Okay, I do not see a relationship between non-lethal weapons, which I was integrally involved with, and the Psi phenomenon. Now, as far as Ronson,
well, let me clarify, so it doesn't look like I'm going off on a wild tangent, because that's how you were drawn in. You were saying, "Hey, we're trying to get these guys to stare at goats and kill the goat," and then later you say, "Well, the goat actually received a karate chop." So this project that you were in was at least tangentially connected, was it not, to weaponization of different paranormal phenomena that would kind of fall into that category, or is that not true? Please clarify.
That would not be accurate at all. That's not in any way connected. What had happened, and even time-wise, there's a bit of a disconnect. By the way, for anyone interested, on my website, just Google my name, I have a complete description of goats and what's real and what's not real. But the problem was that Ronson, was writing basically a comedy, and he took a tiny amount of truth and extrapolated greatly, and then they made the movie. And I have talked to Esloff, who was Clooney's guy who works with him, producing all the time, about it. And they said, oh, they knew that. They just did it because it was funny, not because there's any amount of truth. And I point out that goats did die. There's no doubt about that. And I had actually seen what had happened. Yes, there's a goat lab at Fort Bragg. It is used for Special Forces medic. The idea there is that they want to shoot at the end of the training. You actually get to treat a gunshot wound patient, in this case a goat, so that the first gunshot wound that you actually see is not on the battlefield. A long story, probably don't have time for it, how it all came about, but what happened was the Dim Mac, i.e. the death touch was applied, as opposed to any notion that goats died by staring. That's just completely false. But again, Gloria Estlop saw this as a comedy, and as they went running with it from there.
Okay, I mean, I'm happy to leave it there and happy to accept the correction. It does seem to me over and over again, we get this perception being put forth by Hollywood, by the media, that turns things that are really very serious into this kind of laugh it off, oh, you believe that kind of bunk kind of thing. And this seems...
That's an important point, because it's not just them. You find this in the media as well. You know, when they talk about these stories of various phenomena, UFOs or whatnot, then they tend to end up with a ho, 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 or, oh, you don't really believe that, do you?
Right. So there was a reality to it. It didn't come close to what was portrayed in the film, but you don't necessarily see any grand plan to that misinformation campaign or anything like that, more as just somebody who saw an opportunity to play something for a laugh. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly right.
Okay. Let's talk about alien abduction. John Mack is somebody you mentioned several times in the book, being a Harvard researcher who got very interested in alien abductions, found a reality to them, and then found a deeper, spiritually transformative reality to the alien abduction phenomenon. That has been confirmed by researchers since then. Most recently, my buddy Ray Hernandez at the Edgar Mitchell Experiencer Organization did a large-scale study and found similar findings. I'm sorry, did you want to interject something?
No, I was going to say, I was down at Ray's house earlier this month, actually.
Fantastic. So,
I do know him, and it is a most interesting study. I don't know where you want to go further with the introduction, but the point was, and I have written a chapter for their forthcoming book looking at the integration of many of these phenomena, but he points out that, as they say, the things that start off seemingly kind of scary later do seem to have a transformative and positive response by the individuals, but it often takes a while for them to psychologically integrate those experiences and put in a future context.
Well, there is another side of that too that I think definitely needs to be brought on the table and talked about. I've interviewed several times David Jacobs, of course, an abduction researcher who's come to a very different conclusion. He claims he's come to that conclusion independently and scientifically, and he does have a scientific background. He claims, along with other abduction researchers, that these experiences might be characterized by some as transformative spiritually, but for many, they are true abductions in every sense of the word. And you have been associated with having knowledge of that experience, and in particular, knowledge of military involvement in some of those abductions. And I definitely want to give you a chance to clarify that and to, you know, just come out and tell us, are you aware of any government involvement in programs related to alien abductions?
Yeah, no, my whole MyLab thing, in my view, is totally ridiculous. And I have written to this guy from Austria who was one of the major proponents. And if you look at strictly the requirements that would be necessary, the resources that you'd have to apply to this, it is, you know, just beyond ridiculous. There's no way that you could take that number of resources, particularly when you look at the downsizing that's going on in the military and how you would apply resources. You would be involving thousands and thousands of people if you tended to believe that. I do think that some of these experiences are certainly real. There's probably others that are purely psychological as well. But returning to a comment I made earlier, these have been reported throughout the entirety of human history, all over the globe, every culture. And, oh, by the way, that they happen to come in on little silver discs or something akin to that is actually a fairly new wrinkle to the interaction and abduction phenomena, again, globally reported.
Okay, related to that, another thing to either clear up or to, I don't know, add any information to, you are consistently, John, mentioned as being a member of the Aviary Group, actually having a code name. You're laughing, so I assume that anyone can find...
That's actually true, but not the Aviary Group. This is something that was created, and I can never remember what the name was, but Hal and I and... Scott Jones were at a meeting in in Ohio at the time, and they gave us aviary names, and supposedly it was just so that they could talk freely on the telephone and use names that, that if it were being intercepted, nobody would know who they're talking about. But there is no aviary per se or groups that get together anything like that. You haven't brought up MJ-12. I've been accused of running that, and I always say, if true, would you send them a message because I've been missing my paycheck for from the beginning?
Fair enough, as long as we're going through a list of things to clarify. Misinformation, disinformation, Paul Benowitz, people associated with projects to distort or mind control folks, any knowledge of that at any time, any awareness of those programs running?
No, you know the individuals involved. My position on that is if they did what they said they did, they belong in jail. Absolutely illegal activities that, as they are described. Would have no tolerance for that, nor should it be tolerated.
Fair enough. Let's return then to the UFOs. You tell an amazing story in great detail in the book Reality Denied about your firsthand experience with Chris Bledsoe, his alien encounter, his alien experience that leads to a healing, a physical healing. We're not just a spiritual healing, although maybe that was involved, but the guy's got Crohn's disease and he doesn't have it after the encounter. Ray Hernandez, who we both talked about a minute ago, has a very, very similar story with his wife and their dog, the family dog, that had a similar kind of amazing healing where the dog was dying and couldn't walk and the dog lives. I mean, let's talk about UFOs and healing and this amazing experience that you saw with Chris Bledsoe.
Well, with Chris, I might mention when I was down with Ray, his wife also came in and described to us the incident that happened. And it was quite amazing. And the thing about Chris's case, if I had just listened to this, it was beyond incredulous. I mean, all of the things that happened. But what convinced me was that I had heard this case. I'd interviewed him at great length, went down to visit him, and the family, by the way, is just lovely, and have kind of come together because they've been rather vociferously attacked by the UFO community. But what happened was that we were went down to the Cape Fear River where the incipient incidents had occurred. He described to us what had happened, and physically it was getting early evening, but certainly dark. And so we returned. Victoria was with me along with his daughter, Emily. And we went back up to the car, which was a couple of hundred meters from the river. And women got in the car, and Chris and I were standing there describing, pointing out where certain things happened. And all of a sudden, he turned to me and says, oh, I think they're here. And within about 10 seconds, this thing pops into view above us and went zipping off. Again, it was the temporal relationship between him saying, oh, I think they're here, and the appearance of this object. It wasn't something it flew of. It was not misidentification. It lasted only a few seconds. But that, and then we went back to the house, and there were some other things that occurred near a kind of a mystical tree that's in the backyard there. But it was, again, the personal experience that tends to lead me to believe, you know, the other more fantastic aspects of it. But again, this is one where when you want positive, as you mentioned, he had had Crohn's disease for 12 years. And what he said was the next day, we're skipping over a number of the things that happened, but the following day, he's going around, he realizes he hasn't taken his medicine, but he's not exhibiting any of the symptoms of Crohn's, which is terribly debilitating for many people. Quite a fantastic story.
John, where do people go when they read this book? What's been your experience so far? How is it hitting people? Is it having the effect that you wanted to have? And what effect did you want it to have on folks?
Well, this really is, I can't say an affront. It is challenging our worldview and certainly the scientific community, because we have not talked to a number of the issues there, where we had physical incidents where things that just cannot happen absolutely did happen. With a reindeer shaman in northern Mongolia on the Siberian border, things appearing. We talk about the crystal skull, and I saw the Mitchell Hedges crystal skull, which is probably a fake, and yet we had these phenomenal kinds of things happen that had physical interactions. And what I say is that our laws of science, if you will, are, quite misleading, and things that were, science or maybe guideposts. Not to say that science hasn't been beneficial, because in many ways it has. It is just really incomplete. And we have a problem with many, particularly physical scientists, who refuse to look at data that lie outside of their preconceived ideas.
I really like the way that you phrase that and the emphasis that you put on really incomplete in kind of that's quite a well-played understatement there. John, where is the best place for people to find out not only about the book, but about any other thoughts you have in terms of related to this topic and new discoveries you might be making?
Well, again, I've got quite a bit, and particularly covering some of our travels and backup data for the book, Reality Denied. Best way is to go to my website. Rather than remembering that, just Google my name, John B. Alexander, and it'll pop up.
John, I know this is incredibly kind of intrusive, so a lot of people wouldn't want to do it, but have you ever thought of doing, I don't know, like tours or something like that on some of these trips that you're on? Have you ever thought about hosting people or helping people have these kind of experiences that you've had on a personal basis?
Well, you've got to remember that, when you say many of these were totally unexpected. We once made the mistake of trying to organize a trip and did that. And my temperament is not such with putting up with people who, a lot of these are fairly rough journeys, and they're complaining about the rain or the cold or the food or that is not something of interest to me.
Doesn't jive with an ex Vietnam Green Beret tour of duty kind of guy. So, folks, again, the title of the book is Reality Denied: Firsthand Experiences with Things That Can't Happen But Did. Our guest has been Dr. John Alexander. This is a book that is really a must-have. I mean, the accounts, the history that it encompasses is just not to be missed, and I don't know where else you could go to find it. There's no one else who's had these kind of experiences over this length of time and has written them all down in one place. John, it's been a great pleasure and an honor talking to you, and I really thank you for the time.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks again to John Alexander for joining me today on Skeptico. The one question I guess I tee up from this interview, what do you make of the warrior monk? Is it real in the sense that I was talking about? Is there a need for a warrior among those who are seeking truth, enlightenment, peace? Do we also have to balance that with the warrior? Are we willing to accept everything that the warrior must do to be a warrior? Are we willing to accept the idea that you can't handle the truth? Or even worse, you don't deserve the truth? I think that comes along with the warrior monk bargain, doesn't it? So let me know your thoughts on that. Of course, the place to do it is through the Skeptico website, skeptiko.com, where you can find all our previous shows. You can also check us out on YouTube. I'm interested in video and producing more videos to go along with these podcasts. So you'll find a video of this on the website as well. It's kind of a mixed deal, but you'll see it once you get there. Anyways, check out that as well. Jump over to Skeptico Forum, join the conversation there, drop me an email, comment wherever you want. Stay in touch. Let's connect on this stuff. It's so great having you along for the ride. Until next time, take care. Bye for now.